Hall of Honor, and they'll have people in their organisations whose job it is to kind of promote their own. And it's true with Britain, obviously not being a Catholic country, we don't feature that high up the list. But I think there are people thinking, I mean, the Bishop of Shrewsbury I spoke to, he puts out calls telling people to try to pray to her, to encourage the possibility of miracles happening. So I think there is a kind of a national pride, which with Newman made a big difference.
And I don't think we should leave people on tenterhooks. I think we need you to make a few predictions. Who do you think will be the next British saint, and how quickly might it happen?
I think, even though she's slightly further back in the process, she's only completed sort of step one of four, I think Claire Crockett's a really interesting example. And the Vatican has shown with Carlo Acutis it's interested in seeing younger people who lived more recently, more relevant to people today, going through this process.
Well, it wouldn't be very godly for the bookies to run a book on the next British saint, would it? But I wonder if they do. And if they do, I wonder if they've been listening to you, because they certainly should be. Kaya, thank you so much for coming in, telling us about the process of canonisation. Two, well, let's not say saints, but icons have just walked into the studio. Fee and Rosie, they're going to be with you at the top of the hour. So welcome to them. And Kaya, thank you very much to you. Thanks, everybody, for listening. I'll be back tomorrow. Bye for now.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Icons. I will take it. Stephen, thank you. Good afternoon. It is 2 o'clock. You're listening to Fee Glover and me, Rosie Wright, in for Jane Garvey all this week here on Times Radio.
And coming up on the programme today, we're going to talk more about the threatened bill of $1 billion over that edit of Donald Trump. The legal commentator Joshua Rosenberg will help us through that. How do we remember those who've served our country, and is the UK ready for new conflict? We'll talk to the military historian and journalist Sir Max Hastings. Rituals, robes and funny handshakes, what really goes on behind the Freemasons' doors? Times Radio's Daryl Morris has been inside their London HQ for a new documentary. And our big guest after 3:30 is one of the world's best-selling crime novelists. Louise Penny joins us to talk about her new book, The Black Wolf.
All of that to come, but first, the news with Laura Cook.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Asylum seekers can continue living at a protest-hit Essex hotel after a local authority lost a landmark legal battle. Epping Forest District Council has failed to get a High Court injunction blocking their accommodation. It argued the Bell's owner was flouting planning rules, which the judge dismissed. Shadow Home Secretary Chris Philp is encouraging them to appeal.
Frankly, all of these hotels should ultimately be closed down. In the last 9 months of the last Conservative government, about half the asylum hotels were closed down, went from 400 to 200. And if that rate of closure had continued, by now there would be no asylum hotels at all.
The SNP are calling for the removal of Sir Robbie Gibb from the board of the BBC as the row continues over the corporation's impartiality. Sir Robbie served as Director of Communications for Theresa May. An SNP leader, John Swinney, has said his position is untenable. Journalist John Nicholson worked on Panorama and was also an SNP MP who sat on the Culture Select Committee.
I don't think we should have party political appointees on the BBC board. And when the current BBC chair appeared before us, I pressed him on the issue of whether people should be allowed to retain party political membership when they're on the BBC board. Astonishingly, it appears that Samir Shah, he'd never apparently thought about this, and he was unable to give us an answer. My opinion is clear. No party political appointees of any kind from any party on the BBC board.
The outgoing Director General has told staff the corporation has to stand up for its journalism. Tim Davey, who's quitting over the Donald Trump Panorama edit, says he'll stay on until a replacement is found. Sakir Starmer has dropped the strongest hint the two-child benefit cap will be scrapped in this month's budget. The Prime Minister says he's determined to drive child poverty down through a range of measures. Asked in an interview if that would involve removing the cap, he said we won't have to wait much longer. 9 four-star generals have accused the Prime Minister of allowing human rights law to undermine the effectiveness of Britain's armed forces. In a letter to The Times, the former officers say that today every British soldier deployed must consider not only the enemy in front of them, but the lawyer behind them. Former Foreign Secretary and Times columnist William Hague says it's a serious matter.
I can't remember anything like this. Nine senior generals, many of whom have only recently retired from the army, some of whom have commanded the entire army, some of whom have been commanders of the special forces, for them to write so strongly, and so many of them all together, is a really serious thing. If the BBC wasn't in such a state this morning, this really ought to be the top matter in the country.
And an inquest has heard Dame Jilly Cooper suffered a fatal head injury after a fall at home. The best-selling author was initially alert following the incident last month, but the 88-year-old's condition deteriorated. Gloucestershire coroner has recorded an accidental death. And for a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing on any podcast platform.
Across the UK, on DAB, online, and on your smart speaker, Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wickes Kitchens and Bathrooms.
And just for this week, you're in the company of Fee as normal and me, Rosie Wright, normally sat on early breakfast. Yes, we start at 5 o'clock in the morning, so it has been so nice to be here in the afternoons. Jane will be back next week. Lots to come then over the next couple of hours. As the US president is very energised with his efforts to sue the BBC, we'll ask how the broadcaster faces up to the potentially costly legal, financial and political hurdles ahead. But meanwhile, what of the president's own politics? The longest ever government shutdown in the States. Think over a million staff not being paid, flight delays, shutdown of services. That may be coming to an end. We'll check in to Washington, D.C. This Armistice Day, the 11th of November, we're speaking to the military historian Max Hastings about why some soldiers are losing trust in the state. And as you got a hint of, we are going behind the doors of one of the oldest, most secretive organisations in the world, the Freemasons. I have to confess, I know very little about them. And what I do know is sort of skewed to the negative. That was also the same of Daryl Morris, also of Times Radio. He was invited to take a look. He even got a handshake. So how much of the conspiracy theory around the Freemasons are actually credible? Daryl will tell us more. We're also going to find out what our world leaders watch on the big screen, what it tells us about them. And our big guest at 3:30
is one of the world's most successful crime novelists. So it's Louise Penny, and she writes the Armand Gamache series. My apologies for the pronunciation. We've already done this interview, and obviously when Louise, who knows her character so much better than anybody else, pronounces his name, I realise that I should never say it again in my terrible, terrible English accent. So her latest book tells the story. It's called The Black Wolf. It's a really intriguing tale about state corruption, about greed. And as she says, she wrote it entirely as fiction in 2024, but then woke up in 2025 to see real headlines about one state that wanted to take over another state. She lives in Canada. Mm. She loves Canada. She's got no time for the aggression that was being shown by the new American president. So we talk about all of those things. And if you're a fan of her work, then I think you really, really love it. This is the 20th book in the series. And as soon as they are released, they always go straight to number one. So it was such a pleasure to welcome her to the studio. So that all happens after 3:30.
Should we have a quick look at the most read stories on the Times website then this afternoon? Number three, where is the worst in the UK for parcel theft? More than £600 million worth taken last year. The threat, says the paper, from parcel thieves is growing. I'm sure this problem will get worse over Christmas, not better. Shoppers are turning to doorstep cameras and lockers to protect their purchases. The second most read story is Traitors Joe Marler. The quote here is, I got 30k, we weren't all paid the same. I have to say, Fia, I got a flash notification of this article on my phone this morning, and it is the first thing I read. This is the betrayed faithful Joe on his time on the show, which is going to return for a second series. And the most read piece on the Times website is Andrew may gain a royal title after all, Order of the Hyphen.
Buckingham Palace is considering tweaking Andrew Mountbatten-Windsor's name in accordance with the late Queen's wishes.
So that is a delightful piece written by Sophia Money Coutts, who does have a hyphen about the importance of hyphens. I knew nothing about the importance of hyphens, and I didn't know that in France, in an attempt to separate the old hyphen, which is very established and wonderful, from the new modern, we're just not married, so when we have kids, we're going to bung both surnames into it, hyphen. They actually passed a law saying that you can't do that. Vive la République. You can read all of those articles on thetimes.com. You need your digital subscription. If you don't have one, get one. You can go to thetimes.com/subscribe.
8 minutes past two. Now, some breaking news this afternoon. Asylum seekers are going to continue to be housed at the Bell Hotel in Epping after a landmark High Court judgment. You'll probably remember Epping Forest District Council tried to argue that the hotel landlord had breached planning rules in a bid to stop migrants staying there. Well, there were weeks of protests outside the hotel over the summer after one asylum was arrested over sexual offences. That asylum seeker is also the same individual who was accidentally released from Chelmsford prison a couple of weeks ago. Well, Martin Bentham is Home Affairs correspondent and commentator. Martin, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
There was potentially, wasn't there, going to be an effort from other councils, from sort of Labour, Conservative, Reform councils across the country to pursue the same action, which would have been a huge headache for the Home Office if that had happened. Does this ruling for the Bell Hotel in Epping stop all of that now?
I think it probably does. I'd have to look, and no doubt lawyers will be looking now at each of the relevant councils at precise wording of the judgment and scrutinise it very closely. But in broad terms, it appears that the judge in the case today has said that using planning rules in this way to try to obtain an injunction to stop a hotel housing asylum seekers is not a legitimate method of planning enforcement, and that they also made the point that the Home Office, alluding to your point, has a duty and a need to house asylum seekers. And so it's that marrying off between what local people might want and a local council might want and the broader national need of somewhere to put people who are in this situation. And the judge has come down on the Home Office's side. So it would appear at first sight to be very important from that point of view, not just for the people of Essex who now will continue to have this asylum hotel, but for anybody else up and down the country, who is expecting and hoping their council would do the same thing.
Yes, it looks like be unable to do that. I mean, how much of a relief is this for the Home Office?
I think it's a very big relief because at the moment, obviously, there are a large number of people in hotels, and they've got to find somewhere to put them. The government has pledged to reduce or eliminate the use of hotels, but there are some 30,000 at least people in them at the moment. And clearly, if they're suddenly told that you can't use hotels and there's a wave of judgments that would preventing them from doing so by courts, then they would have a very big immediate problem, which would be very hard for them to solve.
So the problem still exists, it's just not as immediate, is it? The government have been looking at a range of other options, whether that's back to the idea of a boat barge, but maybe more likely military bases. There was one suggestion of saying, OK, we could actually give asylum seekers more money to remove them from hotels and instead send them to any friends, family, relatives that they already have in the UK. What are the most realistic options that the Home Office have got?
Well, at the moment, there are two former military sites being used that were opened under the Conservative government. The current government is exploring and trying to open another couple. Have certainly put in some documents to suggest they want to do that, one in Inverness and one in Essex. Already, those have prompted protests from the local MPs saying it's not a suitable place in their particular area for these sites. So I think that because of the scale of it, of course, using a former military site is a better option from the government, because the idea that you talked about there of trying to disperse people to friends and family, it might work with some people, but it's not guaranteed to work at all in at scale. So I think the only solution for the government, if they're to achieve this ambition of closing down hotels, is to open more military sites. But that those are not easy solutions, because they've got to get the sites up and running, they've got to overcome local opposition there, and of course part of the problem that the housing people in hotels has caused in some areas is that they're a visual, a very visible presence. They probably might be in an area where there aren't so many asylum seekers and people of the backgrounds that those people are coming from, and they've attracted attention, and quite a lot of the young men. Obviously, we refer to the incident involving the Ethiopian and so on. And so whether right or wrongly, some people are worried about crime as a result of the presence of asylum seekers. And so they're always difficult places to open and to have. So even a large military site, unless it's out of town, and even then, you still get into the problem, of course, of the people inside are not in prison. So, and if the conditions there are not very good and are difficult for them and they can't get anywhere, then they become potentially volatile places as well. And so, whichever way you look at it, it's a difficult issue to resolve. And you know, the ultimate solution, of course, is to reduce the number of people in that situation in the first place. But that's a whole different story that the government is grappling with as well.
The much longer problem, of course, is stop the boat crossings and clear the backlog. And then you don't have this issue of where to put all of these individuals in the first place. Martin, thank you very much for the update. That's Martin Bentham, the Home Affairs commentator, on that ruling that we've had this afternoon that asylum seekers will continue to be housed at the Bell Hotel in Epping.
We've got plenty of fun things to talk about on the programme this afternoon as well. We're going to indulge you in a discussion about favourite films. This is a delightful piece that's in the news. Newspaper today. The Vatican has revealed the Pope's four favourite films. They are It's a Wonderful Life, Ordinary People, The Sound of Music, and Life is Beautiful. I think we've gone heavy on the compassion and the empathy there from the new Pope. We will talk to the film critic and filmmaker Jason Solomons about favourite films, but we're very interested in hearing from you this afternoon as to what your favourite film is and why. What is the place that it takes you to? Why do you love it so much? Some breaking news for you this afternoon, though, and we will definitely be talking about this later. A total of 91 prisoners have been freed by mistake between April the 1st and October the 31st this year. That is according to the latest Ministry of Justice figures, which have just been published. So more on that story as we get it. 91 prisoners freed by mistake. It's 2:15. Coming up, what do world leaders watch to unwind at the end of a long day? I've suddenly gone back into reading it out loud mode there. This is Fee Glover and Rosie Wright on Times Radio. Did you spot it? On Times Radio with Wix, the experts in kitchens and bathrooms.
Kate Borsay on Times Radio.
The prison estate swings back into focus as the Justice Secretary David Lammy answers questions in the Commons. Full analysis with Adam Bolton, as well as the other big stories in UK politics. We've got Times leader writer Michael Binion and the former Conservative adviser Jack Sellers picking apart the biggest stories of the day. And Danny Fortson's with us, the excellent host of the Times Tech Podcast, for his regular look at the most important developments in the world of tech.
Kate Borsay, tonight from 7 on Times Radio.
In areas overwhelmed by conflicts and natural disasters, we can't miss a life-saving moment. As a doctor with Médecins Sans Frontières, I've seen how a moment lost can mean a life lost. Right now, MSF is working across the globe, providing maternity care, containing outbreaks, performing vital surgeries. We can't miss a life-saving moment. MSF needs help. Your help. Every attack, disease, and natural disaster puts more people at risk and calls for our teams to go further and faster. Medical emergencies move quickly, so must we. Just £30 will keep our work going and make a life or death difference. The life-saving moment is now. To give £30, call 0800 055 7979. That's 0800 055 7979. Or search MSF Urgent. Thank you.
Ancestry is marking remembrance with free access to global wartime records until Wednesday. Immerse yourself in your ancestors' wartime experiences from the home front to the front line. Explore military records and historic photos and uncover stories of courage and resilience. Register with just your name and email at ancestry.co.uk to start searching with no payment needed. Honour their legacy today with Ancestry. Free access ends the 12th of November.
Listen to Times Radio at 6:30 every weekday morning for your indispensable briefing on the latest politics, business and sports news of the day.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix Bathrooms, the experts in design and installation. From plumbing and tiling to electrical work, the Wix Bathroom Installation Service can take care of everything. Start your journey today by booking your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
So the outgoing BBC Director General Tim Davies says the corporation has to stand up for its journalism. He made the comments in an address to BBC journalists after resigning over those edits to a Donald Trump speech. The US president has threatened to sue the BBC for $1 billion. The advice from the Conservatives' Nigel Huddleston on Times Radio Breakfast was very clear.
I think if you look at the complaint he's got, the TV programme, the Panorama programme, he probably has legitimate claims to say, look, this was wrong, and definitely requires and demands an apology. So I would advise the BBC to grovel here. They need to make sure that they communicate very clearly that they got this wrong and that they apologise.
Well, let's talk to Joshua Rosenberg, KC, legal expert and journalist. Joshua, this case has been filed in Florida. It can't be filed in the UK, can it? What does that mean for its chances of success? Hello, Joshua Rosenberg. Do we have Joshua? I'm not sure that we do. We definitely did. He dropped off the line and we're going to try and get him back. Can I just say that Stuart has texted in the funniest text of the day so far. Early days yet in our show. I was a bit surprised with one of the Pope's film choices until I realised I was confusing ordinary people with Sally Rooney's normal people.
Do you know what? An easy mistake to make, Stuart, because I did a double take. And I thought, surely that is not the Pope's favourite film.
Well, good on him if it was.
I mean, because do they tell the truth when they tell you what your favourite film is? When you ask prime ministers or presidents or politicians, do you think we get the actual answer?
Well, I think there is always an air of cynicism from us, isn't there? The,
absolutely.
The Gordon Brown Arctic Monkeys,
yes,
thing. So I think it can make for a difficult response because obviously they're going to want to choose the most anodyne thing that's going to be the least upsetting to the most amount of people.
But it sounds like a focus group of picks.
Yes, it can do. So we will talk about that. Do keep all of your thoughts about films coming in because it would entertain us through our hard news afternoon. I think Joshua is back. Joshua, hello.
Hello, sorry about that.
Please don't apologise. I just asked you the question, actually, about the status of this claim, because the case is being filed in Florida, not in the UK. So what does that mean?
It means that President Trump thinks that he can do better in the US, and it also means that there's no problem with statute of limitations. He's on home territory if he actually goes ahead and sues, and he's hoping that if he does go ahead, then any damages he's awarded will be higher in the US than it would be in the UK.
There were over 500 complaints eventually about the Panorama programme in this country, but can Donald Trump reasonably claim that that's had an impact on his electorate? What is the difference created by this happening in two completely different jurisdictions?
The real question is how many people would have seen this Panorama programme in the United States. Now, it wasn't, I'm told by the BBC, shown on the BBC's international television services. It was available on catch-up on BBC iPlayer, but that's not available outside the UK in normal circumstances. So the argument by the BBC, if the BBC chose to put this in court, is that no harm was done, very few people saw it, it didn't do any damage, and indeed President Trump didn't even know about it till last week when it was all over the papers here in the UK. On the other hand, what we don't know is whether the BBC wants to fight it in court or whether the BBC would simply put that argument to Mr. Trump's lawyers to argue that any compensation, and that's what he's seeking, should be significantly lower because the damage done is pretty minimal.
Mm. And what difference does an existing apology make to all of this? One has been made already by Samir Shah, and Tim Davey has spoken about his regret too. So what does that change legally?
What they're asking for is an apology, a retraction, and compensation. As you say, there's already been an apology, although in a letter that Samir Shah sent to the Commons Media and Culture Committee yesterday, there was a hint of the BBC trying to explain itself, if not actually justify what it did. And I don't suppose that's going to go down very well with Mr. Trump's lawyers. So clearly, any discussion with his lawyers and the BBC's lawyers would involve a wording, agreed wording by the BBC. They're wanting a prominent apology in the same position as the original programme, which suggests something broadcast on air, on television. They're wanting a full retraction, which I don't think is a problem for the BBC. They shouldn't have broadcast this particular part of the programme. The question of compensation is obviously a matter for discussion. And as I say, the BBC will say, well, not very much harm was done. Mr. Trump will say, well, look at all the damage that being libelled by the BBC has done to me. And they can argue about how much that's worth.
Yeah. I know that you're a lawyer, so you'll probably hate this question, Joshua. But what's the feeling in your waters about this?
I think most lawyers would say that in circumstances like this, it's best to settle for what you can as early as possible, put a lid on it, close the door, move on, put it down to experience and say, well, you know, we'll do better next time. Sure, one can fight these cases in court. They drag on. But then the longer they continue, the more bad publicity emerges. Yes, there are people urging the BBC to take on the President of the United States in the courts of the United States. Yes, there are people saying we must stand up for BBC journalism, and that's the message that came from Tim Davey today. But equally, the BBC has admitted that it was wrong to cut together two parts of a speech, which were 50 minutes apart, and wrong to broadcast pictures after the extract from the speech, which were recorded before the speech and gave the impression to viewers that these were these demonstrators responding to what President Trump had said. And once the BBC has made it clear that it was misleading in its journalism, there's not very much point in fighting this, in my view.
And briefly, if you can, Joshua, as you know, we are all funding the BBC, what is that contract that we have with a corporation if they did have to spend that money settling a case because they'd made a mistake?
Well, that's one of the things you pay for, isn't it? That's what happens when news organisations make mistakes. They have to make amends and they have to make repayment. I think the only thing the BBC could say, if it does decide to settle quickly, is it's cheaper to settle quickly than it is to go to court. Every day in court costs more and more money, and conceivably the risks are higher and higher. So the BBC would have to say that it was the best use of licence payers' money to settle as quickly as possible, if that's what it decides to do.
Right, well, I'm sure that we will talk again. Thank you very much indeed for your expertise. That's Joshua Rosenberg, KC.
You imagine if it goes to court, it'll be bad for the BBC and for Donald Trump, as all of Donald Trump's comments as well will be picked over again.
Rosie, I cannot tell you the amount of upset that would cause in the departments at the BBC that have had to reduce their budgets, lose staff, whole local radio stations being shut down. The idea that would continue because of this, I think, would be so, so painful.
Yeah, very, very challenging. Something more fun, as promised by Fee. After a busy day guiding millions of faithful followers, what film would you watch to unwind? The Times reports today that for Pope Leo, it could be this.
Dove!
A deer, a female deer.
Grey!
A drop of golden sun.
Me!
A name I call myself.
Bah!
A long, long way to run.
The Sound of Music is one of his four favourites, apparently, along with It's a Wonderful Life, The Darker Ordinary People and Life is Beautiful. Film producer and commentator Jason Solomons is here to talk about favourite films of world leaders and what it says about them. Jason, I think we've got to start with Pope Leo. What does his selection tell us, if we can believe them?
Well, I mean, it's a suitably wholesome list. There's not anything particularly controversial about the Pope on there. I mean, he hasn't got Conclave or the two popes, you know, not sort of navel gazing back at himself, but they're very sort of safe and perky. They seem to be about occupied as well. Occupation, Sound of Music and Life is Beautiful. They're both about sort of the Nazis and war. So there's a sort of I don't know what that says about him, but he sort of reveals that he's kind of interested interested in tales of justice or tales of survival up against a sort of foe. And that's what I would say, that those two kind of are bedfellows. Ordinary People's a really interesting one. Maybe he was turned onto it when Robert Redford died earlier this year, and he had a sort of Robert Redford retrospective, and he'd seen Butch Cassidy and Sundance Kid, and he thought, I'll go for one of the ones that Jason recommended if you hadn't seen all Robert Redford's work, and that was Ordinary People, his directorial debut.
Yes, and I'm sure you're absolutely right, Jason. I think it's rather lovely that the Vatican has released these four favourite films, because as soon as you say to somebody, what's your favourite film, they will come back and say, I think rightly, well, it depends what the setting is, it depends what era you're talking about, it depends whether, you know, something that you watch with the family. It's very hard to just have one film, isn't it?
Well, it is, but I've had to have one, Fee, for about 25 years, because people keep asking you, if you're a film critic, they yeah. ask you, what's your favourite film then? So you have to sort of come back with an answer. You can't go, well, it depends, you know, is it Sunday or a Wednesday, it changes. So I've always said it's Annie Hall by Woody Allen. Even when the Woody Allen controversies kept coming up, and people went, oh, you can't have a Woody Allen film, I've kept to Annie Hall, and Diane Keaton's recent death has just kind of made me, you know, adhere to that even more. I have noticed that Goodfellas is also one of my favourite films, of course it is, but I seem to share that with Donald Trump, so I'm a bit, maybe I might alter that one for, you know, world politics interferes sometimes.
Well, we've got a couple of clips now that I think we're just going to try and play back to back, and then we'll talk about who these favourite films belong to.
Oh, I might have blown it.
Of all the gin joints in all the towns in all the world, she walks into mine.
Dodgeball is a sport of violence, exclusion, and degradation.
Ooh, you're out for dodgeball!
Right. Obviously, one of those belongs to Margaret Thatcher. No, it doesn't, actually, Jason. The first one is from Casablanca. Can you guess whose favourite film that is?
I would say that is probably, that's probably someone like Joe Biden.
No, it's Tony Blair.
Is it?
Yes, yeah. It's a classic safe choice, isn't it?
I can see him and Cherie just, you know, whiling away the hours there.
Okay. And then we had Vince Vaughn's Dodgeball. Now, who would you attribute that to?
This one I know. I remember it very well. I think it's Boris Johnson, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
It's his favourite film.
Yes, I know. I've never seen it, Jason. What is it?
You know, it's about people who take up a sport where people hurl balls at them and they have to dodge them. So it's very good for, you know, Boris's tenure when he was mayor, when he was foreign secretary, and when he was prime minister as well. His life was a constant game of dodgeball. So I get that. I do remember him saying that he always liked, his favourite movie character was the mayor from Jaws, who cleared out the beaches and just made safe even when there was a shark on the loose, and he sort of denied there was a shark and kept the beaches open despite all evidence in front of him. That was his favourite movie character. So there you go. I've got some Boris Johnson inside knowledge there.
It's good. Very good.
Do you know, I've got a rule, Jason, about films. It's got to be, if there's more than 30% car chase or fighting, I can't even start to watch it.
And do you have a little guide? I would say in language, but they don't normally say it's 30% car chase.
The trailer is normally a clue, I have to say. And I think I sense it's going to be over my threshold, in which case I won't watch it. I think even 10% over that threshold, and I won't go near it.
I think then you're probably more in the Barack Obama camp. He has a very sort of tasteful film list that he used to come out with every year, and it was always the Swedish rom-coms like The Worst Person in the World, or very sort of finely attuned art house pieces or smart house pieces. I used to love his lists were hugely influential, actually, and people just used to kind of cling to what he would come out with. He loved The Power of the Dog. He loved Summer of Soul, which is a brilliant documentary about a concert in Harlem. He loved Anatomy of a Fall, which is a brilliant sort of film. No car chases in that at all. A long court case.
Oh my God.
Who done it? But I will suggest, Rosie, that you check out Barack Obama's lists because they're right up your calm street.
Anatomy of a Fall is one of the most depressing movies I think I've ever seen, and it's mysterious as well, isn't it? I think it's based on fact. Can you just tell us very briefly about your own movie, please, Jason, because you're not just a film commentator and critic, you are a filmmaker too.
Yes, I have turned film producer since you've last seen me, Fee. And I had my premiere of my first film, what I've produced, last night. It's called Beshared. You might see a poster, he said, having got them from the premiere, sitting on my couch there last night. It's called Beshared. It's a short film. Beshared is a Yiddish expression, meaning it's written in the stars, fated, destined to be. And it had its premiere in London last night, starring Anton Lesser and Kit Rakusen. It's a tender tale of a grumpy old man in a care home who meets a reluctant bar mitzvah boy, and it changes both their lives forever. And we got a standing ovation last night, so changed my life forever as well, I suppose. I'm a film producer now. Maybe one of the world leaders would like to see it and take it to their heart.
I'm sure that they will. Well, congratulations, Jason. It sounds absolutely fantastic.
Thank you.
We are taking all of your suggestions and thoughts about favourite films. We've had so many already. We'll make time for them in the next half an hour.
We will. I have to say, I don't think Obama would have had on his list my favourite film, which mortifyingly is Eddie the Eagle, which doesn't fit into that wonderful category at all. Coming up here, though, Times Radio's Daryl Morris has a rare look behind the doors of the Freemasons. He was invited inside. He'll tell us about that in a moment. First, though, let's get the news now with Laura Cook.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Thank you. Good afternoon. A total of 91 prisoners have been freed by mistake over the past 7 months, according to the Ministry of Justice. The data shows the accidental releases took place between April the 1st and October the 31st this year. It comes as Justice Secretary David Lammy is set to face questions from MPs over the issue. A local authority has failed to stop asylum seekers being housed in a hotel at the centre of widespread protests. The High Court found accommodating migrants at the Bell in Essex doesn't flout planning rules. Epping Forest District Council calls it a devastating decision for local democracy. The BBC's Director General says the organisation needs to fight for its journalism. Tim Davey, who's resigned, told an all-staff call mistakes have cost the broadcaster. Donald Trump's threatening a $1 billion lawsuit over a Panorama edit, which the BBC admits was misleading. But Work and Pensions Secretary Pat McFadden says the corporation's value mustn't be forgotten.
This institution is a big part of the UK. It's a really important asset. It has people who will constantly attack it. It probably always does reports that might annoy some of us one way or another, but we should see through that.
The mother of a 22-year-old woman who killed herself in a mental health unit has criticised staff as an NHS trust is fined more than £500,000. Alice Figueredo took her own life at Goodmayes Hospital in northeast London in 2015 after multiple attempts. An inquest heard best-selling author Dame Jilly Cooper died from a fatal head injury. The 88-year-old was alert after a fall at her home in Gloucestershire last month, but her condition deteriorated in hospital. And for a news bulletin, when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing on any podcast platform.
This is Times Radio.
At Amazon, over 50% of deliveries now come with less packaging or with no added packaging at all. It's a difference you'll notice on your doorstep, where you chat with friends, where your neighbour's daughter practices guitar, and where we deliver your new noise-cancelling headphones in the manufacturer's packaging. Ah. Much better. Reduced packaging from Amazon. We're delivering change where it matters. On your doorstep. Based on 2024 UK and EU Amazon packaging data.
Ancestry is marking remembrance with free access to global wartime records until Wednesday. Immerse yourself in your ancestors' wartime experiences from the home front to the front line. Explore military records and historic photos and uncover stories of courage and resilience. Register with just your name and email at ancestry.co.uk to start searching with no payment needed. Honour their legacy today with Ancestry. Free access ends the 12th of November.
You want work to be less hard work. You hear an ad for MHR, so you reach out. We connect your department systems, which leads to real-time data sharing that uncovers new insights, which empower your decision makers and triple monthly sales, which leads to high fives and awkward hugs. You say a big thank you. We say you're welcome. MHR, the science behind HR, payroll and finance. The science behind a new world of work. Discover more at mhrglobal.com.
Get the day's politics, business and sport every weekday in breakfast from 6:30 a.m.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wickes, the experts in kitchens. Choose Wickes for your new kitchen and then sit back and relax, knowing it's filled with products that are reassuringly backed up with guarantees. Book your free design appointment at wickes.co.uk.
Thank you for all of your detail about your favourite films. Jennifer says, Guess Who's Coming to Dinner is my favourite, made in the early 60s, but it's a story of a liberal family having to face its own racial prejudice. It's just as relevant today. What about Dancing with Wolves with Kevin Costner? That's in from Nikki in Workington. Fantastic film, especially the director's cut extended version. I mean, the real thing was about 3.5 hours. It was the first movie I went to see that had an interval halfway through because it was so long. So the director's cut extended version, that'll take you the whole of your bank holiday weekend. John, what would your favourite film be of all time ever?
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
I've got a few favourite films. Maybe my favourite of all time film is a Danish movie called Babette's Feast, which was, it's set on the Jutland coast. It concerns a kind of Lutheran, tiny village of Lutherans, and a great grand chef from a fine Paris restaurant sort of washes up one day and moves in with this, you know, incredibly austerely living family, a father and two daughters, and it cut to the chase. She ends up winning the French lottery, and she puts on a banquet for these Lutherans of the most astonishing, luxurious food you can imagine. And it's all around that, and it's beautiful, and it's, I suppose it's about possibilities, but it's absolutely, I recommend it to anyone.
Yeah.
I think watch that, and I promise you, if you don't love it, there's something wrong with you.
You're full of surprises, John. That's absolutely brilliant. What is on your show this afternoon?
It's mixed. So I'm looking and seeing David Lammy answering questions on the, you know, the accidental escapes or the blundered escapes, maybe 90 apparently, between April and October just of this year. He ducked this last week, you know, actually appallingly, ran away from questions which he should have faced. And he should answer for that. We'll see how far that goes. As far as the mistaken releases, he did inherit a prison system in an appalling mess. So we're going to see how he deals with both of those issues. But maybe a bigger one today is Lisa Nandy, Culture Secretary, talking about the BBC. How far will she go in defending the BBC? If she does, maybe dealing with the threat from Donald Trump, who's saying he's going to sue the BBC for $1 billion, and the longer-term future of the BBC, all of those things are what we're looking for very, very closely. I'm also, by the way, just going to talk a bit later on about cheating in pub quizzes. A group of pub quizzers who had earpieces in during the thing and watches and that sort of thing and just cheated their way through win after win after win until they were tumbled. You look absolutely appalled.
I really, truly am. So they had someone Googling, presumably, and then relaying the intel back?
Some such thing.
Were they doing this for honour, for pride? Well, there was no honour in that.
No, there were prizes, I think.
How much of a prize was there?
Most pub quizzes have a 10 quid spend at the bar prize.
Like 50 quid or something to cheat. Your integrity's gone.
What's happened to this country?
Absolutely.
It's broken Britain, John. That's what it is. Broken. Thank you very much, John. Starts at 4, goes through till 7.
If I'm ever on a pub quiz, I'm just sort of there for decoration rather than any answers, I'm afraid.
Oh, stop it,
it's
Rosie.
It's true. I did one sat next to Ed Vasey and I was borrowing some of his answers because I didn't know a thing. So, no, it's not my... People think, oh, you'll be really good at the news. I think, well, the news of today. But, you know, anything else rather than that, it's sort of all gone. We are going to take a time now to learn more about the Freemasons, if that ever comes up in a quiz around you. They are one of the oldest fraternal organisations in the world. They have secretive rituals, symbols, oaths, and that means they're often tied up in these sort of wild conspiracy theories about world domination. Well, recently, the Metropolitan Police said they could force officers to declare if they are members. It came after a report criticised the secrecy around the memberships in the service. Well, when Times Radio's Daryl Morris talked about this on his show, he woke up the next morning to an email from the Grand Secretary of the United Grand Lodge of England, Adrian Marsh. Adrian invited Daryl into the Mason's headquarters in central London. And you can watch what happened on the Times Radio YouTube channel from 3 p.m. today. Here's a snippet. This is Daryl talking to the head of memberships, Sean Butler.
English Freemasonry is spread across the world.
How many actual Freemasons are there?
Around 6 million.
6 million?
6 million.
Yeah. Wow.
And this was actually the Master Mason's apron that belonged to Winston Churchill.
Wow, this is Winston Churchill's apron.
You can see his case just here.
How many other Prime Ministers have been Freemasons?
I think it's George Canning, right, who was a Freemason in the 1800s. Other than that, nobody.
And are there many politicians now who are Freemasons?
No, not that I'm aware of.
Really? I mean, and you're the membership guy, so
yeah,
you would know.
I would probably know.
Daryl is with us now. Daryl, what a strange email for you to wake up to. And I wonder, in accepting it, you must have had on your mind this invitation. Right, what's in it for the Freemasons? What do they want to show me?
Yeah, it's funny. You know, we spend a lot of our time, don't we, trying to convince people who don't want to talk to us or, you know, try to get in places. And I think this is the easiest access to anywhere that I've ever had, it sort of sets alarm bells ringing. And I think it became pretty obvious pretty quickly to me that they are trying to do, and the sort of hooked a guess around the accusations linked to the Metropolitan Police of secrecy of officers being unhelpful in investigations and things like that. They're trying to bust some myths. They're trying to open their doors. They're trying clearly to be a bit more open about who they are and what they do. And I guess we'll tease this out over the conversation, Rosie, but it still remains the case. And I kind of pressed Sean and I met Adrian eventually, who's the Grand Secretary, on some of the sort of more sort of mysterious bits, the oaths and the rituals and the symbols. And a lot of that remained on lockdown. You know, they weren't prepared to talk to me really about what all of that involves and also why it is so secret as well in the first place.
Yeah, so what did you work out? If you could sort of boil down to the essence of what it was to be a Freemason, how would you answer that?
Well, okay, this is a good question. So I think The first thing to say what it is that a lot of these kind of rituals are very old, right? And Sean, who I spoke to there, was kind of very keen to point out that they are 300 years old and they are steeped in kind of history and mystery. And he said that if that had been spoiled for him, you know, if he'd known about what some of those rituals were going to be before he became a Freemason, then it would have spoiled it for him and he wouldn't have had it. And I spoke to another Freemason who said something very interesting, actually, which was that the sort of rituals and the oaths and their historical status is a bit of certainty for him in an uncertain world. You know, I think he kind of quite liked the idea that these sort of traditions and rituals that they take part in have been around for such a long time. It connects him to a bygone era, keeps him steady in a world that is shifting and changing very, very rapidly. And I kind of understood that. I think the problem with that is that, you know, you can't sort of have your cake and eat it, really. You know, if you're going to have mysterious rituals, people are going to fill the void with their own theories. And some of those kind of theories are pretty wild. Some of them are actually a little bit more credible, right? Which is, and I know that you talked about this on this show, Jane and Fee did, and you were talking about this idea that there are police officers who are members of the Freemasons. And there was a big report that really criticised the Metropolitan Police after the investigation into the murder of Daniel Morgan. And it pointed to the fact that 10 police officers in that investigation were members of the Freemasons. And whilst it didn't find any evidence of sort of, you know, Masonic cover-ups or using Masonic channels in a corrupt kind of way, and that's something that Adrian and Sean, who I speak to, you know, flatly deny, are outraged by the prospect, it did say that officers being members sort of created an element of secrecy and a lack of trust in the process. And we're talking a lot this week, aren't we, about trust in institutions and things like that. And I wonder if there is some conflicts here. A couple of kind of key things are running, a sort of clashing against each other.
Because there's this idea, and that this is where it's difficult to work out what is conspiracy and what's actually fact, that it is this group of powerful individuals that are in these institutions that do have an awful lot of power. It sounds like, actually, Daryl, you didn't get really an answer to say that's not the case. It could be that is.
Well, okay, so again, I suppose quite a few things can be true at once. They say no, right? Obviously, like, you know, I put a lot of this to Adrian and to Sean, and into Adrian in particular, who, you know, says that it's, you know, there's nothing in their constitution about, you know, about sort of exerting influence or whatever. They are a brotherhood, and so brothers may kind of look out for each other a bit, but no more than they would anybody else in society, et cetera, et cetera. They were at pains to kind of make that point. I suppose the sort of challenge that I had for them, the thing that I came away with, was how do you know? How can you know? You know, how in control is the leadership of this organization over its members and how they use their influence? And they will say, you know, we actively discourage people being, you know, using their Freemasonry in a way that is, you know, unacceptable or, you know, for undue influence or whatever else. And I also wonder if there's something else too, which is if an organization, you have enough members who are sort of in positions of power. I mean, was it 13 presidents have been Freemasons? You know, if you have enough members who are in positions of power and influence, very often they tend to be people in the business community, business leaders, there's a lot of politicians too. Maybe you sort of accidentally rule the world, yeah. If that makes sense.
And can I just make the other point, Daryl, that these are men? So when you talk about 10 police officers involved in the Daniel Morgan inquiry, that's male police officers, isn't it? I mean, the Freemasons allow women to come to certain ceremonies, but you are not a full part of the lodge, are you?
Well, that's interesting because there are now women only lodges of the Freemasons. So they have two female only grand lodges and a couple of hundred sort of individual lodges underneath that, right? That women can be part of. But there are, you know, what was it, say 6 million. The vast majority of them are men. And
that's weird anyway, Daryl, having a separate lodge for women. I mean, it's 2025. Let's have a mixed lodge, surely.
Yeah, I mean, I would be inclined to agree with that. And I guess they would answer that with, you know, that's the sort of tradition and the history that Freemasonry is rooted in that gives it all of its charm and its mystique and that sort of, you know, that sort of belonging that people get out of it, that they are probably loathed to change too drastically because of everything, because of how fulfilling the members find it. But yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's a men's club, yeah.
Sorry to interject. No. When you say fulfilling, I still think I'm not completely clear on what it is that encourages people to join. If you are a Freemason, what sort of principles or ideals are you signing up to, apart from it being this sort of mythical men's club?
Well, we don't know for sure what the oath entails, which is a you know, a good point. They told me that everything is out there, right? There is nothing that isn't, that is a secret necessarily. The problem with that is, you know, when you go online to try to trawl through what people have revealed about Freemasons, there are so many conflicting stories and conflicting oaths that you have no idea which one. Some of them actually have bits in it that are a bit questionable. Others don't. What's the truth? It's hard to know. In terms of what it's a good question, isn't it? Yeah, I think for them, if I was to sort of speak for them, I think it's sort of community, right? I think for some of these guys, it gives them a sense of sort of community and belonging in an era where a lot of that is sort of fracturing. You know, throw in all the sort of mystique of it, throw in the ancient rituals, and I can imagine that being a very satisfying sort of clubs, not for me, but I can imagine it being a very satisfying club to be a part of. And they are a bit, they're sort of dogged with this problem, which is that leads people to sort of be quite critical of them.
And suspicious.
And very suspicious, yeah. And they are at the centre of some extremely wild conspiracy theories, but also some, as I say, some sort of more legitimate criticisms that the Metropolitan Police are obviously grappling with as well. And I suppose there is a sense of them sort of trying to have their cake and eat it in that regard.
Daryl, thank you very much for telling us a few more of the details. You can watch Daryl's documentary on the Times Radio YouTube channel from 3 o'clock today. That's obviously video. It's sort of really fascinating to see inside at the Grand Chamber. It sounds for you as though the way Daryl could actually really find out was to become a Freemason himself.
But I bet part of the oath is that you can't then make documentaries about the Freemasons. Otherwise,
sure.
We would know more about them.
What would the consequence be of breaking the oath?
I don't know. You'd have to go and join the Rotary Club instead. This is the text to end all texts today. It comes in from Michael, who says, just when you think John Pienaar could not have more gravitas or depth unless both Dimblebees were melted down and used to moisturise his authoritative face, he makes a film recommendation on air to end all film recommendations forevermore, driving the debate to new heights like Barry Norman in James Bond's Aston Martin. Utterly compelling. Now, do you know what, Michael? I'm going to take a photograph of that text and I'm going to read it out again in the next hour because it has just brought me so much joy. We're 0333 003 2353 this afternoon and every afternoon. It's Fee Glover and Rosie Wright on Times Radio with Wix. Book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
Hugo Rifkin on Times Radio with Bupa Small Business Health Insurance. When it comes to must-listen mid-morning radio, we've got you covered. There's world-class journalism to broaden your mind, in-depth discussion that gets right to the heart of the issues, and entertaining conversation guaranteed to tickle your funny bone.
And it can be quite humorous.
Hugo Rifkin, tomorrow morning from 10 on Times Radio with Bupa Small Business Health Insurance. Let's get growing.
Listen to Times Radio on your smart speaker. Just say, play Times Radio.
Growing a business takes a powerful team. People who think big, raise the bar and smash expectations. People who are feeling at their best, not worried and waiting for healthcare. If you're ready to take your business to the next level, you need a team that's ready to deliver. Bupa helps your people to get health worries seen and sorted with fast access to expert advice, including GPs and physios. Your team will have fast help for muscle, bone and joint problems, plus mental health services and cancer cover as standard, so they're ready for whatever life throws at them, at home and at work. Take your business further by building a happier, healthier and more motivated team. And as prevention is better than cure, your team will have access to our digital wellbeing services, including 1,500 gym classes, mindfulness programs, and expert content. That's better for your team and better for your business. Get ready to power your growth with Small Business Health Insurance that powers your people. Let's get growing. Search Bupa Small Business.
Here's the truth about AI. AI is only as powerful as the platform it's built into. ServiceNow puts AI to work for people across your business, removing friction and frustration for your employees, supercharging productivity for your developers, providing intelligent tools for your service agents to make customers happier. All built into a single platform you can use right now. That's why the world works with ServiceNow. Visit servicenow.com/UK/AI for people.
This is Times Radio.
Now, Duncan says, do the WI let men join? It's singular. Does the WI let men join? And the WI doesn't, but I think as a man, you can go to some of the events. I don't know about membership, but do you know what, Duncan? I would just say that that's a slightly different thing, because the Women's Institute really identifies itself as being for women. It was originally set up to form a community that could be built by women, for women, to help educate women and to entertain women within the community. And I think for me, as a woman, the Freemasons feels a bit weird because it doesn't identify itself as being just for men. It's just that the women can't participate in absolutely everything that the men can. So is that different enough? I don't know. I am very open to having a conversation about that, Duncan. I'm not trying to shut you down at all, but it just feels a bit different to me. I may be wrong. It's happened. Some NHS health workers are feeling intimidated by the presence of England flags, creating no-go zones up and down the country. Dr. Rachel Ward is a GP and co-host of the Pharmacy Podcast and joins us now. Tell us a little bit more about this story. Have you seen anything like this firsthand?
Good afternoon. So, yeah, the way this story has come about is that it's 77% of hospital bosses have shown concern about discrimination towards NHS staff from public and patients. But also, we know that certain colleges, for example, the Royal College of Nurses, have reported that their members, so nurses, are feeling unsafe and feeling threatened, particularly when working in the community. So we're thinking about, you know, nurses doing home visits, other members of our team doing home visits, mental health workers, GPs, going into areas, and particularly where, you know, there's been a rise in England flags being shown around in different areas, and people have reported that they feel intimidated in this area. Now, some people would obviously say that it's an expression of patriotism. Some people would say that it is a sign of racism. I think the point of this story and the point of the report is that staff who are there to care for people feel threatened by it. And I think that that's a very sad situation, especially when we consider that one in five NHS staff are not British, and 28% of our nursing staff in the NHS are not British nationals. So, you know, that is a huge amount of our workforce that we rely on. And if they are made to feel unsafe in any way when they're doing very valuable work in our communities. I see that as a big problem.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's try and squeeze in these two other stories, Rachel. Our apologies, we came to you a bit late. Children are being treated like second-rate citizens in our hospitals. Now, this comes from the UK's top paediatrician, Professor Steve Turner, so we should take note, shouldn't we?
Yeah, so President of the Royal College of Paediatrics and Child Health, Professor Turner, he has noted in a report that the outcomes for children are worse across the board of care compared to when he started in this profession. He has noted things like huge increase in waiting times, which of course we see across the board. But what we have to remember in children is that in development, in growth, if you're waiting for treatment, you are missing really crucial points, really crucial windows for maximising care. And he gave a great example of children who are picked up as having significant hearing problems, but then waiting a huge amount of time for cochlear implants. And so that's obviously absolutely vital in their development. We know that there are long waiting times. And another point that he has made and as pleading the government with their 10-year plan is if we don't invest in child health, if we don't deal with these problems, it's going to lead to a huge problem in the future with a large amount of adults who were economically inactive and have ongoing health problems. So I think it's a big problem that is storing up.
So yeah, let's take more note of it now. Our final story touches on something that so many people will already be experiencing, Rachel. I mean, this is set to be the worst flu season for decades, isn't it?
It is. So we often, you know, look at the patterns in Australia to see, you know, what we can expect. We base our vaccines, for example, on what they experience. And they have had a really bad year, as has Japan. They have had an epidemic. They've been closing schools because of their rates of flu. We know at the moment that rates are three times higher than this time last year. But also, worryingly, only 62% of eligible over 65s are vaccinated, and less than half of those with chronic disease are vaccinated. We know rates are going to be high. So if you are eligible for a flu vaccine, please, please get vaccinated in the next couple of weeks.
Do what the doctor says, everybody. Rachel, thank you very much indeed.
Thank
Lovely
you.
To talk to you as ever. That is our resident doctor, Dr. Rachel Ward.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
All of that takes us to 3 o'clock. You're listening to Times Radio. It's Fee Glover and Rosie Wright with you until 4 o'clock. We've got a fantastic next hour of the programme for you. We're going to talk to Sir Max Hastings about the future of the armed forces in this country. And one of the world's best-selling crime novelists, Louise Penny, joins us after 3:30. And don't forget, we're going to have a rerun of that glorious text from Mike as well. It'll all happen after the latest news from Laura Cook.
Thank you. Good afternoon. 91 prisoners have been freed by mistake since April this year as the government faces mounting pressure over releases in error. The latest figures from the Ministry of Justice come as the Justice Secretary David Lammy is set to face questions shortly from MPs over the issue. Former Governor Vanessa Frake-Harris says accidental release is a small part of what's wrong.
Unfortunately, for the many hard women and men who work in the prison service, it is going to take more than just stopping, you know, releasing errors to cure our prison service. That's what really concerns me.
A local authority has failed to stop asylum seekers being housed in a hotel at the centre of widespread protests. The High Court found accommodating migrants at the Bell in Essex doesn't flout planning rules. Epping Forest District Council calls it a devastating decision for local democracy. The outgoing Director General of the BBC has said it's tumultuous times, but the organisation will fight for its journalism. Tim Davey was speaking to all BBC staff in the video question and answer session.
These times are difficult for the BBC, but they get through them. And we will thrive. We will thrive. And this narrative will not just be, given by our enemies. It's our narrative.
The BBC is looking for a replacement for the Director General following a report that listed multiple instances of apparent bias, including an edited Donald Trump speech for which he has threatened to sue. Unemployment has risen to 5%, a level not seen since late 2020. The Office for National Statistics says that covers the 3 months to September. It stood at 4.1% when Labour took office last year. But Work and Pensions Secretary Pat McFadden says that we need to look at the bigger picture.
Over the year, 329,000 more people are in work. Real wages are up and the rate of economic inactivity is down over the year. So the British economy is still generating jobs.
A ward manager has been given a 6-month suspended jail term for failings in the care of 22-year-old Alice Figredo. She killed herself in a mental health unit in 2015. The trial heard staff at Goodmayes Hospital weren't told to remove potentially dangerous items and didn't keep proper self-harm records. Judge Richard Marks KC criticised the lack of remorse from Benjamin Ananakwa.
Given the weeks of evidence that you sat through, and the many failings, I find the fact that you clearly remain in a state of denial very troubling.
The North East London NHS Foundation Trust was also fined more than £500,000. Ahead of the Ashes, England cricket coach Marcus Trescothick says Australian pitches should suit their aggressive tactics.
The style of cricket that we generally play is looking to try and put bowlers under pressure. And I think, you know, playing on bouncy pitches where the ball comes onto the bat nicely is always something that we always talk about trying to get back at home because it suits our style of play, which we're quite happy with.
England fans are hopeful the team can win at least a test match down under for the first time since 2011, with 40,000 expected to make the trip. Australia have won the last two home series 4-0 and whitewashed England 5-0 in 2013-2014. The first Ashes test starts next Friday in Perth. And for a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing on any podcast platform.
Across the UK, on DAB, online, and on your smart speaker, Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix Kitchens and Bathrooms.
Thank you for all of your texts this afternoon. We're having a very jolly time reading through them. Clive says, as a Freemason, may I thank you on a well-researched and balanced piece on Freemasonry. Free of innuendo, sarcasm and hearsay, it was quite refreshing. As an aside, were you aware that there are similar Freemasonry organisations for women? There are two in this country. Although not linked, they do happily coexist. I think Daryl did mention that, didn't he? That there are two lodges that women can join.
He did. Because the common criticism is, say, look, this is actually a men's club, particularly talking about those Metropolitan Police officers who were police officers and Freemasons, all of those individuals being men. You can find out more. Daryl's done this fantastic documentary and he admits there's a sort of tension in how he made it because the Freemasons invited him to go. And you've, of course, got to think, you know, what do they want to get out of this? And there are a lot of unanswered questions still. Actually, that documentary just went live on our YouTube page 5 minutes ago, so you can watch it there.
Yeah, but wait until we're off air.
Yeah,
and,
yes, of
and
course.
You've listened to John and you've listened to Kate and you've listened to Carol. Maybe do it at a time in the future. I don't know when. I don't know who I'm going to insult next. This comes in from Mike, who apologises for his lack of punctuation, but he's driving and asked Siri to dictate. So I'm going to say likewise, Mike, apologise if I slightly rumble my way through it. But here we go. A good friend of mine joined the Masons after he left the forces, as I think it was alluded to earlier. It definitely is that a sense of belonging and community and being part of something brings you something more than yourself. And that's key to membership of the Masons. I've been to some of their functions. They're just like mess functions that you might have in the military. They have balls after the meal. They have speeches and a toast. So it is very military-like. They do an awful lot of work for charity and for good. So it's just a group of people that come together and enjoy each other's company. As my friend said, they're not a secret society, just a society with secrets. And he goes on to say, I don't think in any way it's sexist because women are invited to the events.
Yeah, a secretive society rather than a secret one, because of course we do know about them. Can I just do one text from David as well, who I think is more in keeping with my favourite film, because we've been really enjoying the Pope. The Vatican have released the Pope's 4 favourite films. Some of them are maybe a little obvious, but David says, I usually say my favourite films, including this. The first 2 Shrek films, very funny. First has a great soundtrack, which is very important. And the Paddington films, very funny. They remind me of my mum. We took her to see the first for her 50-something birthday a year or two before she died. And she was more rapt and noisy than the children in the cinema. That sounds excellent.
Let's welcome our next guest to the programme. It is always a delight to talk to the military historian and former newspaper editor, Sir Max Hastings. A very good afternoon to you, Sir Max. We wanted to talk to you about several things this afternoon. And we're going to start with the open letter in the Times today, where nine former generals have written warning that soldiers' trust in the legal system has been undermined by human rights laws, noting those deployed today must consider not only the enemy in front, but the lawyer behind. They say that at the moment when the threat of war is rising, this collapse of faith risks everything. Sir Max, what's your reaction to the letter, and do you share this very serious frustration?
Good afternoon, Fee and Rosie. I know all the generals who signed that letter, and I agree with every word they've said, that there is a huge irony and a hypocrisy that all the prime ministers, including Keir Starmer, turned up at the cenotaph to lay their wreaths on Sunday. And all the sentiment, all the emotion is unveiled for the so-called heroes, and there were many of them heroes, of a bygone era. And yet the willingness to throw today's armed forces to the wolves in the name of short-term relationships with the Irish Republic is outrageous, and it reflects an ignorance and folly and almost a sort of treason on the part of the government that they're willing to do this. But essentially, soldiers find themselves liable to prosecution for things that happened 40, 50 years ago, whereas Gerry Adams is never going to appear in the dock. None of the other people who killed alongside him in the IRA in times gone by, none of them face any sort of legal sanctions. And yet soldiers who fought in the Queen's name, and many of them did very brave and great things, find themselves exposed at this stage, a quarter of the way into the 21st century. And it is, the word outrage is often abused by people in our trade. But in this case, it is outrageous. And we've got to try and shame this government into rethinking this terrible bill, which would give this extraordinary license to all the lawyers who, yes, exploit their opportunities at our taxpayers' expense to attack our armed forces. And I remember the sort of thing that happened a long time ago. I was a young reporter in Northern Ireland in 1969. One night in August during rioting, I was underneath a block of flats on the Falls Road, and I saw a police RUC armoured car stop by a block of flats under which I was crouching. And to my amazement, a machine gun on that armoured car hosed down the block of flats. And I heard a terrible scream from upstairs after the armoured car had stopped firing and driven on. And I went upstairs, and there was a nine-year-old boy whom I later found was called Patrick Rooney, lying with half his head blown off. And I helped carry him across the road to an ambulance. He was already almost certainly dead, and he was very soon dead. But the point of the story is that 6 months ago, after this dreadful episode, there was no doubt that the crew of that police armoured car had murdered this child. But they were never effectively, they were denounced in one of the many reports on those riots, but none of the crew of that armoured car were ever prosecuted. But 6 months ago, I suddenly got an email from somebody who introduced himself to me as Patrick Rooney's brother. And he said, "We're still trying to get justice for my brother." And I wrote back to them and I said, "I was there. I felt a passionate sympathy for you for what you went through. But for God's sake, after this interval of 50-something years, there must come a time when we try and lay the dead to rest, when we try and move on. And it's about moving on." Now, that was a case in which security forces have behaved outrageously. Many of the cases that are now being pursued by Republicans and their lawyers are cases in which the armed forces and the Crown behaved absolutely properly, and they're just trying to exploit this for Republican political purposes. But my point is, we must move on.
Sure. Well, thank you for sharing that experience and example with us, Sir Max. But, I mean, the obvious question that I must ask you, though, is how you expect a family who believes that they have lost someone through an unjust action, how are they expected to move on? Isn't the law designed to help those people as much as it should help protect young men and women, even older men and women, who are simply doing their duty?
Of course, you're right. But there must come a time when I would argue very strongly that it's in the interests even of those who have suffered terrible injustice to move on and move to the future and not forever dwell. It's always been an Irish vice that the Irish forget nothing, that with the Irish, the 19th century, the 18th century are as if yesterday. But there has to come a time, if one's to remain a sane society, if one's to remain sane people, you have to be willing to move on. And the debt...
But won't there be Irish people... But won't there be Irish people listening to you saying that? You say, well, hold on. You cannot lump everybody together as having the same experience because of where they're born. And also, you know, the troubles have made life incredibly difficult for an awful lot of Irish people for the last couple of centuries. And many people do not believe that justice has ever belonged to them. So they should be able to believe they can still access it now.
I've written whole books about England's injustice, or Britain's, as we should now call it, to Ireland. So I felt I could claim to know more Irish history than most. And what is more, I saw terrible things done in the early stages of the Troubles, especially to Irish Catholics. So it's not, nobody has ever accused me. I remember at one point I was told by Protestant extremists, they rang up the BBC for whom I was then working, and they said they bombed my father's house unless I apologised on television for being a Catholic lover. So there was never any doubt of my sympathy for the people who fought for civil rights in Ireland in the early stages of the Troubles. But also we owe something. If we want our armed forces to serve the Crown, to serve us, and they do serve us in the way that we're entitled to expect, then we owe a loyalty to them. And it is grossly one-sided. And this is what the generals were complaining about, that none of those who killed and bombed and burned for the IRA in the Troubles are threatened with legal sanctions, whereas soldiers who fought in the name of the Crown, they are threatened today in 2025 with legal penalties. And this cannot be right, this one-sided justice.
Right. So I'll just put to you one final question on that, and then we will move on. I mean, there are people who fought for those dissident organisations who faced justice and spent time in prison.
A far smaller proportion of those who fought for the IRA ever served time. Yes, there was internment without trial, in which many, in fact, which some of us thought was a huge mistake. But nonetheless, you're right that a substantial number of members of the IRA were detained. But my point in all this context is about moving on after a period of time, that whatever happened during the Troubles, when, yes, you're right, that if IRA members were captured during the Troubles and were indicted for a serious offence, then they were tried in a court of law and some went to prison. But we're talking about here and now, 30 years on, or 25, 30 years on, in fact, in some cases, we're going back to the 1970s. And it's the idea that men who were, and women in some cases, who were terrorists, are going to have an ongoing right to pursue legal remedies against the Crown, whereas no such remedies will exist against members of the IRA.
Sure.
It's where we are today that it seems so wrong.
Yep. Do you think that we have actually passed a point of no return on this, and the message that has been sent out to a younger generation who could previously have been recruited to join the army is one of exactly that kind of landscape that you're talking about? You know, you're not backed by the state. You may not really be appreciated enough by all of us for the work that you're doing. Do you think that decline is actually so serious that we can't turn it around?
Well, although the Armistice Day commemorations at the services that took place on Sunday are among the most moving public ceremonies of every year, I'm afraid that I can't fail to see hypocrisy about them, in that so much emotion is expended, and yet we treat the armed forces today outrageously. And we've got to the point where serious serving soldiers are saying that the army is close to a point of no return, that it's become so small, so ill-equipped, so ill-armed, that it is in very close to becoming no longer a credible force. And the lies that are told by government, and the Tories were just as bad as Labour about this, that there were the Tories for 14 years. They kept declaring their support for the armed forces, and yet they did absolutely nothing effective to maintain them. They ran them down, they cut them, and they cut them. And so under the Tories, this situation had evolved where most of the aircraft in the RAF are not fit to fly in combat, that ships of the Royal Navy are desperately undermanned, unfit to go to sea, where whole units of the army, you've got, to me, risible situation, half the Scots Guards manned by Fijians. And the level of equipment, the level of training, all this, and yet you've still got ministers standing on their feet and say, we stand four square behind the armed forces and we are determined to present a credible resistance to Putin.
And
we
exactly,
are not
Smirks,
proposing to make to present that response.
We have a government that tells us we're on a war footing, don't we?
Yeah. Well, this is all nonsense. We are no more fit to go to war. The Home Guard in 1940 was more fit to go to war than is today's British Army. And those generals who signed that, I know from my own conversations with them that they entirely share that view. And this is why they wrote that letter, that we are all being party. And in the end, why do politicians do this? The reason is because they don't think we care. We are voters. They don't think there are votes to be lost over the NHS. There are votes to be lost over welfare. There are votes to be left over potholes and to be lost over potholes in the road, but not over defence. And until we, the voters, can convince the ministers, convince politicians of all parties that we care, that we take defence seriously, nothing is going to change. But I'm afraid we do live in this fairy tale world in which, unless somebody is actually bombing us at that moment, we find it very hard to believe that Putin or the Chinese or the Iranians present a real threat. And it's one of the scariest things across the whole range of politics and government today. Not only are politicians not telling us the truth about a huge range of issues, but I fear that our willingness to listen to the truth, even if it is offered to us, is not very great. We've got to be prepared to get serious. I think the real thing, when somebody says to me, what sort of politicians do you want to rule us? And my answer to that is we want people who are serious, who think about serious issues, and who are willing to talk seriously to us. But in order to get those sort of politicians, we've got to have voters who are prepared to get serious too.
Yep. It's good to hear your thoughts. Thank you very much indeed for joining us this afternoon. Military historian, former newspaper editor, Sir Max Hastings. Plenty of responses from you on that interview. We will get to those in a couple of moments' time. We're 0333 003 2353.
Coming up here, the US government's longest shutdown ever is finally ending. So why then is no one happy? It is 20 past three. This is Fee Glover and me, Rosie Wright, on Times Radio with Wickes, the experts in kitchens and bathrooms.
Times Radio Breakfast with Kate McCann and Stig Abel.
We'll bring you all the day's news and politics coming up on Times Radio Breakfast tomorrow, and we'll crunch the numbers on family makeup when it comes to the two-child benefit cap.
And it's a Wednesday, so Giles Corran and Edwina Curry will be joining us. A bit of Jeopardy for you. Giles Corran is going to the Bob Villain gig. What on earth is going to happen to him?
Times Radio Breakfast with Kate McCann and Stig Abel.
Tomorrow morning from 6 on Times Radio.
Oh, we can all be a bit forgetful from time to time, and Mum was no exception. Always losing her glasses and then not being able to find them again. It's a good job they were two for one at the opticians.
At the last count, I think she had 12 pairs.
Yeah, but there came a point when we noticed that it was more than just being a bit forgetful. And that's when we knew that Mum was going to need someone to give her some extra help around the house.
So that's where we got Claire in to help. She's Mum's care professional from Home Instead. She's wonderful and comes to the house most days. Home Instead are amazing. It really is the best quality care in your own home. And it's really reassuring to know that Mum's being looked after by someone as patient and kind as Claire.
Yeah, and as well as all the day-to-day stuff that Claire does, she also helps Mum with her favourite thing in the world, baking. Mm. Mum's chocolate cake was always the talk of the town, and it turns out that with Claire's help, it still is.
For award-winning home care you can trust, go to homeinstead.co.uk.
Here's to the moment, to the places that give you perspective, and the people who change that perspective. The curiosity that leads you to the edge of the earth, and the joy that meets you there. Silversea brings you closer to the rare, the remote, and the remarkable. On spacious yet intimate ships that show you what most miss. Here's to having every reason to celebrate, to finding more. Learn more at silversea.com.
Download the free Times Radio app and listen to us wherever you are.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix Bathrooms, the experts in design and installation. From plumbing and tiling to electrical work, the Wix Bathroom Installation Service can take care of everything. Start your journey today by booking your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
It is 23 minutes past three. Right, a couple of your thoughts. This one comes in from Robert, who says, this matter concerning the prosecution of service veterans for past events is not just about Northern Ireland and relates to all operations since World War II. The generals who spoke out were not referring to Ireland alone. Anna says Sir Max Hastings is spot on. I know a few people currently serving. The numbers the government keeps spouting about the size of the army are always inflated. The actual number is a good few thousand lower. The housing, although slowly being upgraded for most personnel, is worse than an 80s council prefab, and they are all equipped similarly. The army is as much of a peacekeeping force as it is a fighting force. We need more people to speak out about our lack of preparedness and the lack of interest from our own government to maintain and grow our military. And Anne says, good afternoon, Fee. How arrogant and ludicrous are Max Hastings' comments on the Irish. If any race can't forget the past, it's the English. Right. We are 0333 00032353. It is no laughing matter, actually. And I know it's an incredibly serious and difficult conversation for us to have and to traverse. If you've got any more thoughts, you can always bung them on the email. It's janeandfee@times.radio.
Now it's 24 minutes past three. The longest US government shutdown in history looks like it's about to come to an end. A funding deal has passed the Senate with the help of Democrat votes. Daniel Lipman is the White House and Washington reporter for Politico and joins us now. Daniel, can you just remind us, what does it mean for the government to be in shutdown? Why did this happen?
Well, it means that air traffic controllers, most federal government employees, except for congressmen, actually, were not getting paid. So hundreds of thousands of them who were not essential were furloughed, so they couldn't work. And so it made it impossible to go to the museums, to get lots of businesses to do normal operations if they need government support with permits and the like. And so this has all been caused because Republicans did not want to extend health insurance subsidies as part of Obamacare.
And that's something, of course, that caused a big political row and therefore then this shutdown. How has that been resolved and has it been?
So eight Democratic senators who are more moderate and are not facing the voters next year in the midterm elections, they agreed on Sunday night to reopen the government in exchange for a promised vote on Obamacare subsidies next month. And so they've gotten a lot of heat from the their liberal Democratic bases because they're saying you gave into Trump. We didn't even get the policy victories that we wanted. But Democrats were starting to get some of the blame for keeping the government closed. And this was affecting 40 million Americans who rely on food stamps because they were not getting full payments for food assistance. And so there was a lot of collateral damage We saw the air travel system start to get more chaotic because air traffic controllers were having to work extra jobs as Uber drivers and the like to put food on the table. And you did not want to have a situation where you have a tired air traffic controller directing hundreds of people in planes to make sure they don't crash into each other.
Yeah, or I heard that many of them were sort of calling in sick because they're not getting paid. And therefore, you've got loads of those flight delays, flight cancellations. Daniel, it's quite a weird concept for us to kind of understand what happens, because, of course, this does not happen in the UK. It sounds in the end that for those Democrats, it became to a toss up between do we want the consequence of these sort of, it's 1.4 million federal employees not getting paid versus the concessions they've got to make on healthcare. And in the end, the pain of keeping the government shut down was becoming too unpalatable.
Yeah, and Democrats were happy that they got their fighting spirit back because they're no longer playing dead after losing the elections last year. And they feel like they have the wind at their back because of what happened last week in the elections in Virginia, New Jersey, New York, California, and Georgia even. And so they feel in a good position for the midterm elections. But if they had kept the government closed for many months, then moderate voters who had previously blamed Republicans for the shutdown, because Republicans are the ones in charge, they might have turned on Democrats and say, hey, you're being unreasonable, that the pain of the shutdown is more than the subsidies would have hurt people. And so a lot of those some of those subsidies are going to people who are pretty well off financially. And so there's some kind of edge, you know, things on the edges that Democrats might not be able to defend. But they might still be able to reach a deal to extend the subsidies, because this deal to reopen the government is only until January 30th. And so part of it could shut down again if they are not able to clinch a deal.
Yeah, you can imagine. So the negotiation's very much a live issue. While we have you, Daniel, we've been talking sort of at length over the last 2 or 3 days here in the UK about this battle that the BBC have currently with the US President Donald Trump over this misleadingly edited clip that was on one of our Panorama programmes here. What has been the reaction so far for your colleagues in Washington and also the American public?
Well, I think the American public was kind of shocked a little bit that the BBC would make a mistake in terms of splicing his clips together, where they could have easily just used a technique in TV to make clear it was not at the same moment he was talking about, fight like hell and go to the Capitol. And so this hurts the reputation of the BBC. But this is also another example of Trump going after the media. And he's sued ABC, CBS, The Wall Street Journal, The New York Times, lots of media organizations. And he was very happy to get a scalp with the director general and the head of news resigning over the weekend. But I don't think that this hurts the BBC long term in their American audience, because their American audience is pretty anti-Trump anyways. And so but it may kind of elevates the BBC into just another news organization that Trump has gone after to try to undermine the credibility of mainstream fact-based reporting, as opposed to conservative outlets that are less fair.
Just very quickly, Daniel, from your experience of your colleagues and other reporters from other news agencies, when the President of the United States comes after your news organization, how much more difficult is it then for that reporter who's got to be at the White House and potentially ask questions of him as well?
It becomes more difficult. And so I don't know if BBC is going to get an interview anytime with a lot of Trump officials, because they don't want to get the blowback if they had, done an interview and then the White House says, oh, you did an interview with the BBC? How dare you? And so it does become more difficult. But for a lot of reporters, you're not going to get the best stories by just going to the White House. And so I try to stay away and cultivate confidential sources far away from the White House.
Thank you for giving us a little bit of the inside track. Daniel Lipman, the White House and Washington reporter for Politico.
Right. Linda and Cherie in particular, stand by, because you're going to very much enjoy our interview after 3:30 with the crime novelist Louise Penny. Let's get a check on the latest news headlines first with Laura Cook.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio.
Thank you. Good afternoon. A total of 91 prisoners have been freed by mistake over the past 7 months, according to the Ministry of Justice. The data shows the accidental releases took place between April the 1st and October the 31st this year. It comes as Justice Secretary David Lammy is set to answer questions in the Commons over the issue. A woman convicted over the UK's biggest ever money laundering case linked to over £5 billion in Bitcoin has been jailed for 11 years and 8 months. 47-year-old Zhu Min Sheehan fled to Britain in 2017 after running a Ponzi-style insurance scheme that defrauded more than 128,000 people in China. A local authority has failed to stop asylum seekers being housed in a hotel at the centre of widespread protests. The High Court found accommodating migrants at the Bell in Essex doesn't flout planning rules. Epping Forest District Council calls it a devastating decision for local democracy. The BBC's outgoing boss has sought to rally staff as Donald Trump threatens a $1 billion lawsuit over a Panorama edit. Tim Davies says although mistakes have been made, the broadcaster must fight for its journalism. And Ireland's new president, Catherine Connolly, has been sworn in at a ceremony in Dublin Castle. The independent politician won a landslide victory in October's elections. The former barrister and psychologist takes over from Michael D. Higgins, who'd been the head of state for 14 years. In her first address as president, Ms. Connolly spoke about climate change, ongoing wars and division.
These are the challenges of our times, and our actions or inaction will determine the world our children and grandchildren will inherit. It is both an individual and a collective challenge.
And for a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing on any podcast platform.
This is Times Radio.
Some people think solar only works in summer, but at Hive, we're here to show you solar works all year round, no matter the weather.
Like heavy rain, still working.
Wind,
yep, still working. Sleet that's basically sideways, you guessed it, still working.
Power is getting the sun to work for you even in winter, helping you to cut your bills and lower your footprint, putting you in control of your energy. Search Hive Solar, know your power.
Can I come down now?
Performance varies by season, weather, roof and system size.
Here's the truth about AI. AI is only as powerful as the platform it's built into. ServiceNow puts AI to work for people across your business, removing friction and frustration for your employees, supercharging productivity for your developers, providing intelligent tools for your service agents to make customers happier. All built into a single platform you can use right now. That's why the world works with ServiceNow. Visit servicenow.com/UK/AI for people.
Let's hear from the Chancellor, Geoffrey.
From the Chancellor, Nigel. Chancellor, John.
Norman.
Kenneth.
Gordon.
Alistair.
George.
Philip.
Sajid.
Rishi.
Nadine.
Kwasi.
Jeremy.
And now Rachel. Another year, another budget. Over the past 40 years, we've seen it all. Our experts will continue to filter through the noise and uncertainty, helping you make the most of your tax allowances. Hargreaves Lansdowne, helping Britain invest through it all. Capital at risk. Tax rules applying can change.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix, the experts in kitchens. Choose Wix for your new kitchen and then sit back and relax, knowing it's filled with products that are reassuringly backed up with guarantees. Book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
It is 25 minutes to four. Louise Penny is one of the most successful crime writers on the planet. 18 million books sold, translated into 30 languages. And when the latest instalment in the Life and Crime Times of Chief Inspector Armand Gamache is published, the books go straight to the top of the bestseller lists here in the US and particularly in her native Canada. Armand is a delightful chap to spend time with. Calm and wise, he does human frailty and strength in equal measure. And he's not just plucked from Louise Penny's imagination. He shares a lot of the characteristics of her late husband, Michael, who was diagnosed with Alzheimer's in the 2000s and died in 2016. Now, Penny came to writing relatively late. Her first book, Still Life, was published in 2005 when she was 45, and it took quite a few rejections before a publisher took her on. And those books are now full of politics and the search for truth, often revolving around the rural community of Three Pines with its bistro and hot cinnamon buns. But corruption, greed and murder play out. The Black Wolf is the 20th novel in the series. It's about climate change, the force of a neighbouring state and a lust for power. And at the beginning of the book, there's an interesting author's note where Louise notes that she wrote the book in 2024, only to find in 2025 real-life headlines about America's desire to take over Canada that had become very much a reality.
That was a shock, and that was what President Trump started saying about Canada and that Canada should be his 51st state. And that's one of the plot points in my book, that not for the same reasons that he's describing. He's describing trying to bring Canada to our knees financially and making it necessary for us to join the United States. It's very difficult to tell whether he's serious or not. But in my book, there is a progression that makes it clear that this is not outrageous. However, when I wrote the book, I did sort of think, have I gone too far? Is anyone going to believe this? And turns out I didn't go far enough.
Yeah, I mean, this is a lighthearted fantasy by comparison by now, yes. to the reality. Yeah. Right. But there is so much politics with a small p in all of your writing, because what mm-hmm. you're looking at is injustice. What you're looking at is the fight between good and bad. So actually, to have it writ large on the political, with a capital P, horizon,
right.
does it make your job easier or harder?
I think it does make it easier. It makes it easier in the writing because, as I said, you just follow what seems to be from one possibility to the next, to the next, to the next. You come to this conclusion, as I did in the book. It makes it more difficult doing things like this, to talk about what's happening now, to state my political beliefs, to take a political stand as well, to come out of the shadows and stand in some glaring spotlights. So that then became a moral decision on my part that had to be faced. But the actual writing of it, this particular book didn't make it more difficult. And as you said, though, all of the books really have, or many of the books, particularly the last, I would say, since book six, have had political elements to it.
Mm. Do you think that there's anybody listening who still needs an explanation of Three Pines?
Of what I'm talking about?
Well, I mean, you are one of the world's most successful crime writers.
True.
It is true. It is true. Yeah.
Yes, let me tell you a little bit about Three Pines. I mean, clearly you know. Thank you so much. Three Pines is a village in Quebec, south of Montreal, close to the Vermont border. It's a fictional village. Before I started writing, was very taken with Gabriel Garcia Marquez and Isabel Allende and magical realism. So I knew I wanted to create a village that was both felt very real and very recognizable, very approachable, but at the same time have an element of mystique about it. For instance, it's described as not on any map. The GPS only ever shows people that they're wandering into a wilderness, and then this village appears, that it's only ever found by people lost. And that was, again, that wasn't just a turn of phrase that sounded interesting. That was absolutely planned, because we all need a harbor. We all feel so lost. We all feel wounded at times, and we need that safe place. And that's why I created Three Pines as that harbor. Not, as you know, physically safe, thankfully, because murders do happen there. And we can never guarantee physical safety anywhere. 9/11 proved that. 7/7 proved that. But we can guarantee emotional safety, and we do it by having a community around us. And that's, while the books are very much about crime and a crime novel and corruption and terror and all the things that go with it, at their heart, they are about belonging.
Now, you say that Three Pines is a fictional place, mm-hmm. but my stepmother has just been to Canada and Quebec, and she told me that she'd been to Three Pines. Where's she been?
Oh, dear. Maybe, well, I won't say.
But are the villages that can legitimately claim to kind of be
Oh, for sure. Yes, you're absolutely right. Yes. I would like to know where she was, but it's loosely based on the village I live in, which is Knowlton, Quebec. But also inspired by other villages in the area. For many years, I traveled around. I was with the CBC, and I traveled every 2 years to, with my job, moved up the ladder as a CBC journalist and host. But I found myself getting more and more disconnected and, frankly, quite lonely. I didn't have roots. I had a lot of acquaintances, but no deep friendships. And I found that very painful. And I realized that I needed to find home. And I didn't know where that would be. So I ended up, as a child, I was very happy in Quebec. So I thought, I'll go back to Quebec and maybe find a home. And I lived in Quebec City for a while to learn French. Then I moved to Montreal, met Michael, moved south to this tiny little village. And that's where I found home. Mm. And then that's what the books are about. They're about home, and that's there. It's inspired by that desire to find home.
And how much of Michael would we, as the reader, find in your main protagonist in your books?
A great deal. I think if you saw a photo of Michael and you'd read the books, you wouldn't necessarily say, "Oh, that's Armand." Physically, a little bit, but not so much. But certainly in every other way, in character. Armand is a happy man. It's very unusual in crime fiction to have this character who is content. He's happy. He's the adult in the room. He has he's the tiller, the hand on the tiller. And he's a happy man, not because he's just a little bit too stupid to know how cruel the world is. He sees it every day. But he chooses to be happy. And he has that in common with Michael. Michael was the head of hematology at the Montreal Children's Hospital, which made him the doctor you don't want to meet. And he had to tell young parents things no young parent should ever have to hear. He sat beside the children and held their hands into the night. And yet, he was happy because those children taught him what a gift life is and what a betrayal it would be for those of us who get to live life if we don't live it with courage, with integrity, with joy, with gratitude. Michael was filled with gratitude that he got to live and live fully. And the same with Armand.
Do you mind me asking about how you deal with that creatively when you've lost somebody you love, but you have put part of them on the page, and we, your readers, expect you to carry on writing about that character? Is it painful, or does it bring you comfort?
Michael was diagnosed with dementia and died a few years later. I didn't think I'd be able to write after losing him. I thought it would be just too painful after losing my Armand. But yeah, then it was clear to me. I thought, I will take a year off. And I took a couple of months off, and then I found myself back at the laptop and just sort of noodling around, trying it a little bit. And I went back into Three Pines and I wrote a scene in the bistro, and that was so comforting. And then Armand appeared, and I realized that Michael is immortal now. I can visit him anytime. So tomorrow morning I'm going to be back writing the book and being with Michael.
Does it matter to you if readers join your amazing back catalogue kind of at any old number? Or do you think actually it is one of those series where the reader benefits from going all the way back to 2005 and still life?
Yeah, this is the 20th anniversary. Well, let me turn it around, because I know you've read the books. What do you think?
I love Armand, and I'm so sorry that my accent isn't as good as yours. I'm just going to have to go Armand. I think what I've really loved about him is that he is a fictional figure to whom lots of things have happened in life. And actually, in crime fiction, often the character stays the same. You might not know, whether Jack Reacher is 42, 52, 22 or 32 in the book that you join him in. But I think Armand has been on a journey. So I think actually it is one of those back catalogues that you should start at the very beginning and work your way through. I don't think it would matter if you got kind of 13 and 14 muddled up, but I think you should start. But do you disagree? And of course you can, because you've written the book.
No, I don't. I do. I'm so glad you said that, because I do feel badly, because people are listening to this and book 20 is coming out and we're telling them to go all the way back to book one. But borrow it from a friend, take it out of the library. Big supporter of libraries. Get it secondhand. Do buy it from your independent. Yes, I think there is such an evolution, not just of Armand, but of the other characters too. And that was important for me too. I think one of the problems, I heard that Agatha Christie had grew tired of Poirot. I'm not sure if that's true or not, but that's kind of the myth. And I think one of the reasons is he never evolved. He was essentially the same in The Mysterious Affair at Stiles, the first one, with the very last one. He never got married, he never had children, he never really had an affair, nothing. So I wanted to have a character who would grow with me. And that, I think that's what's making him, make it the series still alive for me and him still of interest to me.
We should talk a bit about the book without giving away the plot of the book, because it's obviously tough. It is tough, isn't it? But you're a talented professional at this, so you're going to be able to do it. But there's so much in here, isn't there? I mean, one of the huge threads of all of your writing, and particularly in this, is our need to love planet Earth, our need to look at what is happening if you take your eye off the ball and don't appreciate nature. And as you've alluded to already in the interview, there are forces at work looking at Canada, preying on Canada, that don't have nature at its heart, do they?
It's a look at what happens when you have a great deal and your neighbor has next to nothing. And your neighbor has what you want and needs what you want. What happens? I think we can guess what happens. Canada is resource rich. That was something that was once mocked. Now the resource rich nations are becoming the apex nations. What happens when your neighbor to the south is running out of those resources? And that's what this is about. And it's also, it's a call to awareness. It's a call to action for Canada as well as the United States. Because I can see the time when very distressing things will happen.
Is Mark Carney doing a good job? We like to think of him as a little bit of our own,
yes,
but actually he does belong to you. And, I mean, it was... You can't imagine, actually, that Mark Carney would have thought 5 years ago that...
That he'd be Prime Minister.
Be Prime Minister of Canada.
No. Well, I think he's doing a much better job than the Conservative would have done. It's an interesting... I'm a supporter of his, big supporter. I would not make a very good politician, because I am pretty sure we'd be at war by now if I was. Because I mean, I think we should stand up to the bully. I think we should say no more oil, no more water, no more rare earth minerals. Nothing goes across the border. And like immigrants who come to a new country and sacrifice their generation for the next, that's what we will be doing. My generation will be sacrificing for the next generation as we resituate our economy and find other outlets.
You say that nothing will go across the border. I mean, you won't go across the border to publicise this book, will you?
No, I won't. I'm refusing to go into the States until this travesty ends. So I didn't do a tour. My American publishers were unbelievably supportive, because it's a blow. It's a blow to me, but it's certainly a blow to them.
But is there an argument as well that in doing that, you take away some of the power of the people who don't support President Trump, who, you know, probably are politically aligned with you, would like to go to an event and meet like-minded people and champion what you're doing?
That is a really good point, and that's something I hadn't really taken into account when I cancelled the tour. But I have been asked that since and had to reflect on it. I simply couldn't. I consider this a moral issue, not a political one necessarily. Had the Democrats done the same thing, I would have done the same thing. I would have felt incredibly uncomfortable going to the Kennedy Center to launch this book and haranguing them in their own house. I don't think I would have felt comfortable doing that. And I think going there would have been close to acquiescence. And I just can't. Mm.
You've been so phenomenally successful in the last 20 years of your life. Do you ever stop and think, who's the other Louise Penny, the one who didn't finally get published? And I know that it was, you know, it was definitely a kind of battle to get that first manuscript accepted, wasn't it? It wasn't an absolute shoo-in.
That's such an interesting question. I wonder who I would have been. Huh. Yeah, I don't know. I probably, maybe fewer gray hairs. A lot more compost under my fingernails because I had to give up gardening because I don't have the time anymore. I don't know what would have become of me. I hope I would have been, I think, and this might be a conceit, I think, and this came from a number of things, not just being around Michael, but I think at rest, I am a happy person. And I think I still would have been happy and content with whatever the universe gave me and grateful for it. But this has been beyond anything I could have ever dreamed. And it's just so fortunate when I say that, and lucky. And some people get upset when I say that and say, well, luck has nothing to do with it. It's all skill and hard work. And there absolutely has to be that. But I know a lot of writers who are probably better than I am, who haven't enjoyed the sort of success that I have. And so I am very aware every day of how lucky I am and how fortunate I am.
How do you feel about the AI scrape? Because you and I both know that if I was to type into a well-known chatbot, write me the opening paragraph of a Louise Penny book.
It would. And it may be unrecognizable or indistinguishable from what I would write. I'm very afraid. Now, I don't want to come across as a Luddite. I don't want to be a Luddite. But the fact that there are no guardrails is really terrifying for any creative, for me, for you, for actors, for musicians. And people say, well, the soul of the book can't, surely AI can't create that. And I think probably not, but I think people's expectations can lower over time and people will just say, well, it's still a Gamache, it's still set in Three Pines, it's okay.
Yeah, I completely agree, and I think it's such a dangerous thing that we're witnessing in plain sight.
In plain sight, I am glad I'm 67 where I am with book 20, because if it all goes away tomorrow, I'll be very sad. I'll still keep writing just for my own joy. But I wouldn't want to be trying to put out my first book at this time.
That is the fabulous Louise Penny and her latest book in the Armand Gamache. My apologies again for the terrible pronunciation. Series is called The Black Wolf. It was a real, real joy to meet her.
Now it's coming up to 4:05. John Pina will be here then. But in the last few minutes, the Justice Secretary, David Lammy, has been speaking in the Commons about the mistaken release of prisoners. He's been trying to explain why he repeatedly avoided answering the Conservatives' questions last week about the release of a prisoner when he appeared at Prime Minister's Questions.
Importantly, my officials had not had confirmation about whether or not he was an asylum seeker. Indeed, it was not until later that afternoon that the Home Office confirmed to the Ministry of Justice that he was not. Given the nature of the opposition's question, I made a judgment that I would wait until I had all the detail, rather than risk giving an inaccurate or incomplete or misleading picture to the House about a sensitive case. Members opposite may argue that they would have handled the situation differently. All I can do is be open about the factors I was weighing at the time, and that the data in the system we inherited is painfully slow. I thank the Speaker for the opportunity to update the House in full today.
I'm not sure that answers all the questions or why he couldn't then update the House in full the day after when he was asked to come and answer questions. But there we go. David Lammy's also confirmed there are currently 3 mistakenly released prisoners at large. Well, keep listening to us here. John Pina will have much more on this story from 4:00, I'm sure.
This is Fee Glover and Rosie Wright on Times Radio with Wix. Book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
The Evening Edition with Kate Borsay on Times Radio with the new Volkswagen California camper van. Embark on an evening expedition, rounding up the latest news and previewing tomorrow's headlines. Plus, don't miss Hit the Road, your essential weekly travel guide to the best destinations across the UK and beyond. The Evening Edition, tonight from 7 on Times Radio with the new Volkswagen California camper van. Designed for every adventure. Search New Volkswagen California to find out more.
Download the free Times Radio app from the App Store or Google Play today.
It's another busy Sunday in the Thing household. Mr. Thing is leaf blowing, Ash is watching the footy, and the twins are power washing the cars and everything else in sight. They're all making the most of half-price electricity from British Gas. Available every Sunday from 11am to 4pm with Peak Save. One of the ways we're taking care of things. Search British Gas half-price electricity to see what you could save. T's and C's apply, up to 60 kilowatts per session. Eligible tariff and smart meter required.
Those who are curious feel an urge to travel, to explore the world. At Viking, we create voyages for the thinking person. Because travel enriches the mind and connects cultures in meaningful ways. With small, modern, all-veranda ocean ships that were designed to bring you closer to the destination, discover the world's iconic cities and quaint villages. Exploring the world in comfort. Learn more at viking.com.
Nice. Direct Line just sorted me a courtesy van. Well, they're fixing mine after my accident. That's how it's done. Imagine if that's how everything got done. Like clients paying you on time.
All done.
Brilliant. Your invoice is all paid up. Left you 5-star reviews. Oh, and a bit extra in there for staying late that time. And I baked this cake for you too.
Nice.
Direct Line. That's how it's done.
Comprehensive cover required. Courtesy van limited for up to 21 days if your van is written off, stolen, or you use your own repairer. Excludes windscreen claims.
This is Times Radio.
Well, that's almost it from me and from Rosie for today. We've got a fabulous guest for you tomorrow. It's Katie Prescott, who is the Times' technology correspondent. She has written a book called The Curious Case of Mike Lynch. So he was the autonomy boss whose company had got into difficulty, shall we put it that way, with Hewlett-Packard. And you'll remember he very sadly died with his daughter and so many friends on his super yacht. The book by Katie Prescott is extraordinary in its forensic detail about everything that happened during that time.
And John Pienaar's next. We're delighted to say he's already in the studio to listen to this tribute to you, John.
Here comes this most amazing text of text we received earlier from Michael. Just when you think John Pienaar could not have more gravitas or depth unless both Dimblebees were melted down and used to moisturise his authoritative face, he makes a film recommendation on air to all end all film recommendations forevermore, driving the debate to new heights like Barry Norman in James Bond's Aston Martin. Utterly compelling. Well, take it away, John.
What an incredibly kind thing for our listener to write in. But do listen. Watch the movie, Babette's Feast. That was the point of that. You'll be glad that you did.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Thank you, Fee. Thank you, Rosie. Thank you, our listener. It's 4 o'clock. I'm John Pienaar, and this is Times Radio Drive. Here are the headlines. It's emerged 91 prisoners have been released in error between April and October this year, according to Ministry of Justice figures. And as Donald Trump threatens the BBC with a $1 billion lawsuit, the outgoing Director General has thought to rally staff. And coming up, the Culture Secretary's statement on the crisis at the BBC. We'll have that for you live as it happens. And we're going to be hearing from a former Attorney General, Dominic Grieve, whose latest report finds the law used to ban terror groups is being used too widely.
This is Times Radio.
Now the news with Laura Cook.
Thank you. Good afternoon. 91 prisoners have been mistakenly released between April and October this year. Figures have been released from the Ministry of Justice. Several high-profile cases have increased pressure on the government to address the crisis. There are currently 3 mistakenly released prisoners at large. Justice Secretary David Lammy has admitted there's a mountain to climb and apologised to victims of crime.
I give an unequivocal apology to all who have faced worry or worse as a result of releases in error, especially Hadish Kabati's victims, who I'm offered to meet. Mr. Speaker, I hope the Right Honourable Gentleman opposite will join me in that apology to all who have suffered because of releases and error under this and previous governments.
A woman convicted over the UK's biggest ever money laundering case linked to £5 billion worth of Bitcoin has been jailed for 11 years and 8 months. Jumin Chien fled to Britain in 2017 after running a Ponzi-style insurance scheme that defrauded more than 128,000 people in China. The Met Police's head of economic and cybercrime, Will Line, says the 47-year-old, nicknamed the Goddess of Wealth, lived in luxury.
She was renting numerous properties. She had an entourage of people that were supporting her, cooking, driving, that kind of thing, spending quite a lot of money on travel throughout Europe, jewellery, other nice things.
The decision on the use of the profits could be crucial for the Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, who's reported to have earmarked the seized cryptocurrency to shore up the government's finances. The BBC's outgoing Director General has tried to rally staff as Donald Trump threatens the corporation with a $1 billion lawsuit. It's over a selectively edited speech on Panorama appearing to show the US president inciting violence. The broadcaster has until Friday to comply with various demands. Tim Davey, who's resigned, has called on the BBC to fight for its journalism while acknowledging mistakes have been made.
These times are difficult for the BBC, but they get through them. We will thrive. We will thrive. And this narrative will not just be given by our enemies. It's our narrative. And the key thing is the BBC is more than one person.
It's claimed counter-terrorism measures and the anti-radicalisation prevent scheme are being used too widely. An independent commission suggests the current definition of terrorism is too broad and extends beyond acts of violence or serious threat. It's made 113 recommendations, including reviewing a decision to proscribe an organisation every 5 years. Former Attorney General Dominic Grieve wants greater scrutiny over the process.
You can't single out a particular one. You've got to take the package, or you've got to reject the package. So we suggest it would be much better if we can have a system where only one proscription takes place at any one time.
George Ford has been named a fly half for England's Autumn Rugby Union International against New Zealand this weekend. Winger Tom Roebuck and fullback Freddie Stewart return among 7 changes from the win over Fiji. Captain Mara Toje comes back in while Finn Baxter and Jamie George start in the front row. And for a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing on any podcast platform.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, John Pienaar, at Drive, on Times Radio.
Hello, I'm John Pienaar with Drive on Times Radio. Thanks for joining me. Now, the Culture Secretary is juggling the red-hot potato of a BBC in crisis. The Justice Secretary is trying to keep his own job on the rails, while the prison service looks like tipping over. How's your day going? And what's the worst job you've ever had? Well, as I speak, the row over the state and the future of the BBC has landed in the lap of the Culture Secretary, Lisa Nandy, who's going to be reporting to MPs shortly. Now, will she defend or criticise the BBC, which just saw its Director General and Head of News resign in a storm of accusations? Accusations of BBC bias. Will Nandy weigh into President Trump's sensational threat to sue the BBC for $1 billion after calling the BBC corrupt? Now, US networks face the same threat, and some of them backed down, maybe couldn't face making an enemy of the man in the White House. What's the UK's national broadcaster to do? Can Keir Starmer's government steer clear of the confrontation? And maybe more important in the longer term, will the Culture Secretary share her thinking on the BBC's funding and the future of the licence fee? Well, we're going to see how Nandy plays it in the Commons very soon. And I promise you'll hear it live on the show. It will be a tough test. But at least the Culture Secretary wants to consider the BBC's future. Today, as I speak, the Justice Secretary, David Lammy, is finally facing the music in the Commons about all the mistaken releases of prisoners and the, frankly, rather incompetent way that he dodged questions about it last week. And I'll get you up to date on that in just a moment. No, Nandy, Lammy, Keir Starmer, the Chancellor Rachel Reeves, who is on thin ice ahead of her manifesto busting budget. Who's got your sympathy or not? And do throw in the worst job you've ever had. If you like, send me a text, 87222, start with the word Times, or a tweet to @TimesRadio. So then, before we catch up with David Lammy, who's in his tight corner over the release of prisoners mistakenly, let's catch up on what's hit the BBC and the Culture Secretary's imminent statement to the House of Commons. And we can talk to Ollie Wright, the Times policy editor. Hello to you, Ollie.
Hello.
Ollie, welcome back to the programme. So, Lisa and Andy, we're clearly treading, Ollie, a difficult and delicate line between the BBC and its critics and managing the relationship with an angry President Trump who's on the warpath and her own role discussing the BBC's future and its future funding.
It really is, yeah. I mean, yeah, the BBC has always been a political football, I think it's fair to say. And, as you know, listeners will remember the last crisis and the crisis before that. And, you know, there will be crises in the future as well. But I think this one is difficult. You know, the organisation is fundamentally rudderless. It's lost both its director general and it's lost the person that runs its news operation. And there's no sign that either of those jobs are going to get replaced anytime soon. And I don't think that Nandi will want to be seen as a BBC critic. I think she will want to be seen as a friend. But as you point out, she's got quite a careful line that she has to walk.
Yes, I mean, and when it comes to President Trump and his lawsuit, I guess the government will want to keep as clear of this as far as possible. But the government won't want to see the BBC, the national broadcaster, publicly funded, beaten and humiliated by President Trump, will it?
No, and they won't want the spectre of the licence fee paying money to Donald Trump either. But I think on that issue, Nandi will just sort of walk away from it entirely and say, you know, the BBC, and she's right, is operationally independent. How the BBC decides to respond to Donald Trump is up to the BBC, and it would be wrong and inappropriate for the government to intervene. I think that is, you know, A, sensible, and B, broadly right. But it won't stop people sort of pointing out the political ramifications of the President of the United States suing the UK's national broadcaster.
Yeah, and the ground and the backdrop. It is pretty tricky stuff. How does this fit, in your view, to the really political battle about the BBC's place and role in our politics and in our media?
I think it is really critical, and it's particularly critical because obviously you've got the whole issue of the charter renewal, which is coming up. Now, you know, how do you fund an organisation like the BBC? Now, there's one bit of it which is broadly commercial.